Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 15th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for the Science Forum on Vox Pop, and we have a panel of experts here to answer your questions. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email your science questions to voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551, the Science Forum. Your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum. The experts are here. They're champing at the bit. They're ready to go. The number to call is 800-348-2551. If you have a science question, 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet your questions at comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But the number is 800-348-2551. All right, we have a full house here for the Science Forum. Let's have our panel of experts sign in, please.
Ooh, we have a Studio Vogel Skill Day.
Oops. Your mic not working?
I don't know. It's on. It's on?
Yeah.
It's on. Now I hear it. Excuse me. Now I really hear it.
Now we've cleared our throat. We've turned the mic on. Let's start the show.
Oh, gosh. SUNY Coble Skill. This is Barbara Brabets. I am a biochemist. I teach biology and chemistry, surprisingly.
Hello, Barbara.
Hello, Ray.
Hey, this is Carmen Greenwood, SUNY Coble Skill again, otherwise known as the Bug Lady. So I teach a lot of bug-related classes, entomology, terrestrial invertebrate ecology, conservation biology.
And a reminder to our listeners, no questions about stink bugs, please, tonight.
And I'm Roger Giaboni, and I'm just an engineer, and I teach.
Oh, you drive trains? You drive trains?
I do.
Oh, good for you.
Ed Stander, I am the third of the Unholy Trinity from SUNY Coble Skill, and I teach geology, astronomy, environmental science, and anything. I answer anything that the others cannot answer.
So there's three of you from Coble Skill today. That means
school is not yet in session.
Is there anybody over there right now?
Oh,
is
it all... We got out of a meeting to be here.
Did
so,
you really?
It's good they can't hear us.
That's right, and nobody else. Oh, no, we do have a couple of calls. The number here is 800-348-2551. Of course, Barbara, everybody in the world is now talking about this new state of matter that they've discovered.
Thanks, Ray.
What have you learned?
I've learned nothing because it was announced 3 hours ago.
So we have a new state of matter.
Right. Just to recap the states of matter that were known prior to 3 hours ago, there's the solid, the liquid, the gas, and then if you really want to go crazy, there's the plasma, right, which is an ionized gas.
That pretty much covers everything, right?
We thought it covered everything.
What else could it possibly be?
I'm thinking it's a supercritical fluid, which is really not new, but that's where you get a fluid that moves like a fluid, but behaves, it's compressible like a gas. So it ends up with characteristics of both liquids and gases at the same time. And we use that because that's really handy, because expanding and contracting normal liquids is not something that they do well.
So this could be one of those situations like Pluto, where they just change the sort of description of the, it's no longer a planet.
Right. Maybe it was a statoid of matter, and now it's a state of matter.
Statoid. That's very good. And a reminder, once again, please, no calls about stink bugs today. We do have Carmen Greenwood with us. Roger Giaboni is here, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabets, and we would love to take your calls. And look at the calls coming in.
Uh-oh.
I mean, isn't this amazing?
It's because you said stink bug three times.
No, and remember, folks, no calls about stink bugs here today on the program. And now let's go to Brian in Red Hook. Hello, Brian. How are you?
Good. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
So, my question is just wondering the amount of energy to go up a hill, either by walking or going up by a bicycle, is it the?
Oh boy. All right. So
I think we get the gist.
Basically, is the energy used going uphill the same walking or riding a bike?
Depending on what gear you're in or whatever.
Okay.
You want me to
go for it, Roger?
You're the engineer.
So I'm glad you called in a half an hour before the show started because we needed to think about this one.
Okay.
The answer is it's the same. What you're doing is you're changing the amount of potential energy going up the hill, okay? And you're either doing it by walking or by riding, which require different levels of power to derive the same amount of energy. But because you're changing the same height, the energy requirement is the same.
But what about the weight?
Okay.
What about the fact that you're now carrying a bike up the hill?
Well, that's force through a distance, right? So that's work. That's more work.
That's right.
Right.
Okay.
So if you walk or jog, so let's take the bike and throw it down the hill.
Fair enough.
If you walk or jog, you actually burn the same calories. Of course, it takes you longer to walk up the hill than it does to jog, unless it's me, and then my walking and jogging speeds are the same.
Very good.
Right. And so when you look from power has a time component to it.
Yeah.
Power is what tears muscle and rebuilds muscle. So if you want the added benefit of buffing up besides just burning calories, then the exercise that takes less time to accomplish the same feat actually does more bodybuilding.
And you can even do better, of course, if you jog up the hill carrying your bicycle.
I've done that too, that's not my idea of fun.
Brian, thanks for that one. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's the Science Forum today on Vox Pop. Benjamin in Rexford. Benjamin.
Yes, hello. My question is about scientific breakthroughs, you know, things like gravity or quantum theory or going from first in flight to the moon within a century. It seems like progress has slowed down. Do you know what's going on with that and if that has anything to do with maybe like the reproducibility problem in science?
Well, Benjamin, I'm just going to quip here and say 3 hours ago, they discovered a new state of matter.
Exactly.
So I'm thinking that maybe scientific breakthroughs are still coming at us pretty quickly. I think a lot of technological science used to be funded for the sake of science. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the 18th and 19th centuries, what would happen is the royalty or the wealthy landed gentry of Europe would pay people to do science, to kind of be like their science pets. And so there was sponsorship in the same way that the arts were sponsored, right? Mozart didn't set out and write these things in his backyard, and he was sponsored to write what he wrote. And same with science. It was funded. And the funding has really waned, I'd say, in the last 10 years or so, where it's much more difficult to get science for science's sake funding.
Not military.
Yeah, there has to be an application. So, like, gravity obviously has military applications, but if gravity hadn't been discovered and somebody wanted to study this idea that we stick because of something, I'm not sure anybody would fund it at this day and age.
If I could add something to that, is that in science usually works on the concept of paradigms. Something happens that makes everybody suddenly jump on that bandwagon and doing work. And so it's true, the paradigms are pretty well spaced out. And then once you hit a paradigm, then all of a sudden everybody jumps on it and starts doing work in that area.
Right, the technology piece.
Right, so we have global warming, for example, which was effectively a paradigm shift of about 40 years ago, that there's something going on. And so a lot of people are working on that. And so the money gets spread out over a large area on those subjects until something else comes along that becomes more important, and then the money goes to that.
Can I comment on the technology element of that? I think the technology piece, and it's interesting you mentioned the flight to the moon. I think there's a cultural component when it comes to technology. I think we've got a much more risk-averse society today. I don't think we'd ever put guys on the moon in the conditions we put Apollo 11 on the moon.
Agreed.
I'm not saying it wasn't a great engineering feat. It was tremendous.
But it was daring.
There was a tremendous amount of risk, and people were lined up to do it. And today, I don't think we have that.
Also, thank you for the call, Brian. Also, could it be that we're a little more jaded? Some of these things that are happening and the things we are learning are pretty amazing, but does the public care as much anymore?
Well, you're talking to four scientists. Well, three scientists and engineer, just to be specific.
Okay. Right.
So you're going to get a different answer in this room than you'd get walking around the supermarket.
But you see students every day.
I do. But again, the students I see are either there because somebody pushed them into my science classroom or because they see the value of science. I often ask someone, why are you a science major? And they're like, well, I didn't know what else to do.
Right.
And I say, so you picked the hardest thing possible? Like, good for you. Like, you need a head scan.
Nice.
Because, you know, if you have to have some inkling you want to go in that route, the route of discovery, the route of curiosity, the route of risk taking, in order to be a scientist, because it's not just, you know, accounting is not risk-taking.
Oh, it is if you come up with the wrong numbers.
Depends on who you were accounting
for. Good accounting?
Right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Reminder, no stink bug questions on the program today. Carmen is very upset about it. Carmen Greenwood here, who's a stink bug expert, but she doesn't want to talk about that. So just we'll leave it alone. It's the Science Forum. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Ray Graff with you and the science panel today. What a great panel we have. We have Ed Stander, Barbara Bravitz. Why are you laughing? It's true. Ed Stander's here, Barbara Bravitz, Roger Jaboni, and international stink bug expert Carmen Greenwood here as well, but no calls about that today. Hey, before we get back to the calls, I have a question. Who knows anything in this room about radiation?
Ionizing or light?
Sure. Yeah. Well, okay.
Electromagnetic.
Russia had a missile mishap.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Kind of
and I saw in the news, and who knows what to believe and what's true and what's not, that briefly the radiation level spiked like five times.
16 was the latest reading.
16. Come closer to the microphone.
Sorry, Roger, 16 Andrew. Times.
And then allegedly, within hours, it was back to normal. Right. What kind of radiation are we talking about here that would be that transitory?
Short half-life isotopes.
Yep. Right, or gamma radiation burst from something that
or
was critical,
burst, right.
And then they threw lead right. around it.
Or a small amount of regular material that wound up in the ocean afterwards.
Interestingly, though, a day or two later, they said everybody from the town has to leave for a little while.
Oops.
Vacation.
Yeah? Can we make any uninformed speculation about what went wrong there?
I unfortunately, you know, we've all been prepped with the Chernobyl experience,
yeah.
And we just don't believe what's coming out of Russia,
right?
Which is unfortunate.
Well, frankly, any nuclear accident, any accident that has a scientific component where you have to explain it to the masses, it's an easy way to disguise what happened because you can say, oh, it's just science. I just got done reading Midnight at Chernobyl, which is a book that the series was based on. And it is amazing what people who knew what was going on were screaming like, guys, this is a big deal. And they were like, no, it's fine. And what happened is they had two different dosimeters. These are things that would read radiation levels. One is kind of like your low background kind, your Geiger counter.
Right.
And the other one was made for industrial like accidents.
Yeah.
And it was maxed out on the Geiger counter, but the scale was only going so high. It didn't go any higher. And they said, no, it's like this much. And it was like tens of thousands more. But because it had maxed out on the reader, they were like, no, that's good. We're going to write that one down.
Now, when did Chernobyl happen? 30 years ago? Okay. A little over 30 years ago. What do we know about the area that was basically abandoned now and the wildlife there? I've heard
some
amazing stories.
Very interesting things going on.
Yeah.
The wildlife has re-inhabited the city, and it appears to be quite natural. But the other thing that's very interesting is there's a whole cottage industry of tourists going there.
Yeah, people like me who just read that book.
Are you allowed to go there now?
You can for short
periods
of time.
Visiting, right. They have visits that you can take a bus to. There's a vodka called Atom that has just come out.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yes, because vodka in the Russian society is thought to be an anti-nuclear agent. So it would be an emetic. It would fix you if you were dosed by radiation.
Well, it would if it was orange juice with it.
Oh, really?
What is orange juice?
I think the boron chaser would be the one you want.
True enough. Well, the vodka has a problem in that it makes it more difficult for your body to assimilate vitamin C, so you take the orange juice with it,
right.
And that levels it off.
I like the idea of the boron chaser, by the way. I might, next time I go
your
to...
Your body might not like it.
But it's very interesting what's happening in Chernobyl.
Does that mean that, and we'll get right back to the phones, 800-348-2551, the quick spike in radiation, does that mean that they were probably experimenting with a nuclear engine on a rocket, or was this some?
What the speculation is it was a hypervelocity missile that used a reactor as the burning component for the thrust.
Ah, interesting.
And apparently it ran away. That's the speculation.
And that makes sense.
And that makes sense from
and
what
I read an interesting piece that apparently we fiddled around with this in the 50s and 60s and could not get it to work.
They got it to work, just not the way they wanted.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, and we go to Jason in Amherst. Jason, you're on.
Good Good afternoon. I have a question about cell phones and such. So let's say you get 100,000 texts, you get 10,000 pictures sent to your phone. Does, on a theoretical level, your phone get heavier? Does its mass increase? And if yes, is that mass at all measurable?
Electron by electron. Okay, thanks a lot.
The answer is that if there isn't some place to store it already on your phone, then there's no way to keep it there. So effectively what you've got is a memory modules in there, and all that the pictures are switches on that memory module that change it from a 0 to a 1.
So think about a wall in your basement that's 10 by 10, and it's populated by up-down light switches all the way across and all the way down. The combination of how those are up or down is how you relay analog information in digital form. So the light switch weight doesn't change when you flick it up or down. It stays the same. It's the configuration as a whole that relays the information.
And maybe just to help clarify it, when you receive texts or images or messages, you're not transferring electrons into the device. Now, electrons have mass to them. So you're not transferring electrons into the device. You're just rearranging the electrons in the
memory. They're already there.
Using a microwave signal, which is energy, not mass.
Right.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, and Vicky is in Durham. Vicky, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Hello, how are you?
Good, good. I just have a question about a wolf spider.
Ah.
We just bought a house, and the basement is like kind of a damp basement, and it's really a cellar, not a basement. And I discovered on the stairs, I took a picture of it, and it came up as a wolf spider. Mm-hmm. I had never seen one before. And so I researched a little bit, but it says it's good to have them. They don't spin webs, and they actually eat other critters.
Yes.
And I just wanted to know, is that true? And because I don't want anything to happen to it.
We'll throw this over to Carmen.
Yes, actually, yeah. that is correct. We have a lot of wolf spiders around here. If you walk around in the grass outside, you'd probably see hundreds of them. They run around. They eat other insects.
How big are they?
They do not make webs, and they can get pretty big.
Yeah.
I don't know about the size of them.
Yeah, this is at least 3 inches or 3.5 inches.
Oh, that's a biggie.
Yeah, they're not dangerous for people, and they eat other insects. So
they won't bite you if you sat down on one by mistake?
I've never known anybody to be hurt by a wolf
okay.
spider.
All right.
So no radioactive wolf spiders.
No.
All right, fair enough. Vicky, do you want to
Except
follow up with a question about stink bugs at all?
No.
Your wolf spider will eat your stink bug.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, there we
yes.
are. You see, we've come full circle.
There we go.
Vicky, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number.
One level of separation. That's all we're looking
it's
for.
Beautiful. This email came in from our buddy Jules. Jules writes, recent experiments with entangled photons have indicated that future events can affect the outcome of past events, at least on the quantum mechanical level. Any comments?
Ouch.
I'd be worried if I were
an
electron.
It already hit me.
That's funny. Anybody, any quantum?
It's really hard to do quantum entanglement on the radio.
All right, Jules. Well, sorry about that.
Should we
one.
Take it as homework just to give Jules her due time?
So you're
she
going
did
to do
type
homework.
The email.
You're going to do homework on
quantum entanglement? Yeah, and time.
Right.
Good luck. I'll figure out a way to do this on the radio.
Okay.
That'd be cool.
And while you're at it, look up that next state of matter.
I'm just looking for the lottery numbers.
Chris in New Paltz is on. Chris.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, as always.
You're welcome.
My question involves what is actually occurring when you cut something with a knife or with scissors?
Well, what's...
Is that...
Yeah, that's okay.
The
what's,
edge...
It's what's happening
the
is...
The edge of...
Go
oh,
on.
Okay.
Go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say, my perception is that the edge of the cutting material has a width, even though it's very small, and that when you're sharpening that piece of metal, you're narrowing that width. So is that width just so small that it can actually go in between the molecules of what it is that you're trying to cut?
Well, basically, yes. But basically what happens is you're taking a very small amount of energy, which is what you're putting onto that knife when you cut down, and you're focusing it on a very, very, very small area. And so force is equal to, force is related to the amount of area of contact. And as you decrease that area of contact smaller and smaller, the force gets higher and higher. So you're able to cut things because you're putting so much force on a very small area. While, for example, if you were to put it on the ground and step on it, you wouldn't be cutting it.
Even something like cutting butter with a butter knife, you're putting force on a wider wedge, but you're actually heating up the butter at the molecular level because you're putting the force on it, because there's the expansion and contraction and is related to heat. So you can turn that force into heat energy, and that will help you cut the piece of the tab of butter off.
That's a great question. Chris, you want to follow up?
Okay, so I just want to say the reason why you couldn't cut a diamond with a piece of steel is that the amount of force necessary to separate those molecules is, you can't apply enough force to it then?
It's that the diamond actually cuts the steel as you're trying to cut the diamond. It goes the other way.
Okay.
Right, so that's why, you can only cut diamond with diamond.
Interesting. But I can break glass with steel but not cut it?
Glass you could do.
Yeah?
You could. Like those little rollers that you can buy your window, because you're taking all that force and putting it on a really, really, really concentrated edge.
And that's how they make diamonds, is they put a lot of pressure on a very, very small area. So they're able to actually compress it enough to it's almost to the point where it's pressures and temperatures in the upper mantle.
But what, with artificial diamonds, if you were not a gemologist, would you be able to tell the difference?
Oh, you'd certainly be able to tell in terms of what's inside the diamond, because a diamond usually forms down in the earth and it comes up at very high supersonic speeds, really. And as it comes up and cools, pieces of the material are trapped inside of it. So you can usually tell where it's come from and actually how deep
it was in
the
earth. If it's too pure, it may be artificial. Is that?
That would be my guess.
Standard rule of thumb. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, Carmen Greenwood, and Roger Giuboni here on the Science Forum. And now over to Mark in Salem. Mark.
Hi, Ray.
Hello.
I'm going to change the subject 180 degrees.
Great.
I was interested in thunderstorms. I always took atmospheric science in graduate school, and Bernie Vonnegut actually was one of my professors. And I've always wondered. I've had two opportunities in my life to watch a storm from a distance, where I could see how the cloud interacted with other clouds. And the thing that always puzzled me, and this may not be, maybe the engineer might be able to tell you, when you have an aerosol, which is what the upper droplets are, what is the resistance, or what is the voltage per foot, or that you have to overcome in order to make a flash?
Well, you've got to break down the atmosphere, right? So what happens is you reach the ionization point, and that depends on the moisture content, the particulate content. So that varies from application to application. But I am of the opinion.
Mostly they're small particles. I mean, you've got a piece of gunk in the middle. That's what it condensed on.
Mm-hmm.
So there's thousands of these small particles, but per cubic centimeter. So what would you guess that would be the voltage required to go?
It's millions of volts, millions of electron volts.
It still is millions of volts.
Millions.
All right.
And what's even more impressive is the amount of current, tremendous amounts of current.
But it only lasts for a millionth of a second.
Yeah, but it's the current that gets you.
Well, Mark, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. Roger the Engineer, wasn't there a Yardbirds album entitled Roger the Engineer?
Not that I'm aware.
You'd remember Ed, right? Old
Roger
Yardbirds
McGuinn.
Album?
Roger McGuinn.
I don't think Roger McGuinn, but I think there was a Roger the Engineer record. But we digress. Bob in Middletown. Bob.
Yes, sir. I was just wondering, I heard a program on WAMC about how to get numbers beyond 0 and 1. How do you get like 248 to using 0 and 1? And I found out that you have 0 and 2 to the 0 power, which is 1, 2 to the 4th power, and so forth. That was great, and I was taking notes on that. But the thing is, I asked is, how do you develop get numbers that like 2.3 or 2.45?
Oh, so decimals.
More digits.
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
More digits.
Yeah.
That's all. Just more ones and zeros.
Oh, I see. Well.
So each integer has a specific exponential value to it, as you said.
Yes.
0, 1, 2, and so forth. So the more integers you add, the larger the number you can create.
Okay. How do you get the point the point, you know, separate the whole numbers from decimals?
And I'm gonna defer on that one,
Carmen.
Oh, okay. Well,
I think it's going to be more significant digits. It's just going to be more digits, and the decimal place.
Isn't the decimal place sort of a random? You could just keep moving it if you want to move it.
Well, you have least significant digits and most significant digits, and the way you space the binary number out is just more on either side of that balance point.
I think for a lot of the sophisticated, it's simple division. You take binary numbers, you divide them, and then you end up with a decimal.
Ah, there you go. Well, Bob, thanks. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum today. Who has been waiting the longest here? Looks like Michael in New York City. Michael, you're on.
Hi, yes, thank you. I have a question about water, the physics of water. If I recall, it's made of two molecules of hydrogen and one of oxygen. My question is, can you make water? Can we crash oxygen, say, into hydrogen and come up with water?
Sure
and
can.
If not, why not?
Sure you
Thank
can. You. Yep. It's just not that there's a lot of hydrogen laying around because it tends to react, and oxygen too. But you can create pure hydrogen, react it with oxygen, and that's a spontaneous reaction at almost all temperatures and pressures. One of the driving forces for most chemical reactions, there's only five real driving forces. One is the creation of a gas. One is creation of a solid. One is the creation or freeing up heat as a part of that reaction. There's one other one that's kind of trivial. And then the other one is the formation of water. So a lot of reactions spontaneously make water as a product, and that includes hydrogen. H2 plus O2 makes two H2Os.
Don't the spacecraft fuel cells?
That's exactly how
right.
they do it.
Right.
They take liquid hydrogen, actually solid. There's SRBs, so... Well, I don't want to get too complicated about rocketry here, but the space shuttle itself uses hydrogen and oxygen to do its little maneuvers with its own inboard engines.
Right, and it's effectively what was produced when the Hindenburg blew up.
Right, in Apollo 13, they were mixing the oxygen tank when there was a spark.
Yeah.
Because they used hydrogen and oxygen to make water and then used the electricity that was made from that
right.
To make energy. And it was the mixing of that oxygen tank that blew up the Apollo 13
mm-hmm.
module.
It's the Science Forum on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Carmen Greenwood is here. Roger Giboni, Barbara Bravitz, and Ed Stander. Your calls, more of them coming up. Favorite of scientists for years, it's Maynard Ferguson on the Vox Pop Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the number. We have a great panel today, and one of our guests, not here that often, because frankly, you don't get that many questions about stink bugs. Carmen Greenwood, you have an event coming up you want to talk about.
It's not an event.
All right. Well, I was given improper information. What is it?
No, I brought with me an article.
Oh.
I was told quite frequently the panelists will bring articles with them on.
Oh, so it's not an event you want to promote?
No.
That's me.
All right, let's hold that for a minute and let's let Barbara do her promotion and
okay.
then we'll go into your topic.
Certainly.
This is exciting.
Certainly.
I wish we had known about it at the beginning of the show. Would have been great.
It was all the stink bug lead up. Not speaking of stink bugs, our college semester starts the last week of August.
Now, what college is that?
That would be SUNY Cobleskill.
Ah, thanks, Barbara.
It's about 35 miles from Albany.
Okay.
And one of the trends we're seeing in the popular literature is that college isn't worth it, not worth it to the students and the families for the high cost of what it is. And I just wanted to say that Cobleskill is unique in a unique pile within the SUNY system in that it offers both associate's two-year and bachelor's degrees, four-year degrees. And some recent literature has come out to show that if you're looking in a technical field, if you earn an associate's degree, you'll earn about 80% of what someone with a bachelor's degree will earn. So 2 years of schooling... and you can go and increase your buying power significantly. So if there's anybody out there that's driving from one job to the other and is like, geez, you know, I really didn't want to go for the whole 4 years,
right,
but I'm not really liking where I am right now. We still are taking applications, admissions at cobleskill.edu.
This is great.
I think technical educations are great. That the challenge becomes is applying it.
Right.
I think that one of the biggest challenges and we do a lot of work with young kids and interns, and they're bright, and they know their technical information. They don't communicate well. They don't have leadership skills. And there are some good leadership programs out there. Syracuse has worked with the Dooley Leadership Experience, which is an educational program for young professionals, and it's. You know, they've got to learn to apply
right
in the real world.
And the good news is, as part of the SUNY system, we are part of a general education program. So students are required in a 2-year degree to really hit all of those marks in 10 areas.
I had a chat with a young lady, I won't mention her name, just yesterday about the question was, is college worth it?
Mm-hmm.
I said,
it
depends.
Comes up.
You know, what you want to do. If you want to end up in radio, feel free to relax,
We wouldn't be here if we didn't have degrees, right?
Well, there you go. Hey, Carmen, now you had a topic, and I apologize we didn't get to this earlier. What are we talking about here?
Oh, it's not a problem. I just brought an article with me. It was something that's come out recently, and it's a topic, I guess, that's relevant kind of locally. We've had a problem with one of our local invading insects.
Yeah, which one?
Emerald ash borer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And when people hear about emerald ash borer, they think about, you know, losing all their ash trees in this area. And that probably will happen. But the article is kind of interesting because it points out something we don't really think about, and that's the insects, the specialized insects that rely on ash trees that we'll also probably lose. And that's about 100 species of specialist insects that will also probably go away when we lose ash trees.
And the emerald ash borer came from Asia?
Yes, this is another,
another gift.
Yeah.
Along with the stink bugs.
Yes, another one of our invading insects. A particularly bad one.
It came how? In furniture that was packed on ships? How did it come?
It was in pallets, I believe.
Yeah.
The pallet.
Exactly right.
The pallet wood.
Yep.
That was underneath shipments.
Well, that's interesting. And we talk often about the emerald ash borer on the gardening show. And,
You
know, Fred Breglia, an arborist, he just says there's not much you can do about them.
Cut them down and burn them down now.
Well, that one thing they do point out, we do have some natural enemies that are establishing that may help with the process. And there's also some hope that some of the ash trees will be resistant. So some of the foresters, if you have a lot of ash trees on your property, they do recommend, you know, that you maybe think twice about cutting down all of your ash trees.
Interesting.
Because it does slow down the establishment of these natural enemies, and also slows down the possibility or, you know, minimizes the possibility of maybe saving the genetics of a resistant ash tree that might be out there. So... you know, they suggest things like maybe harvesting the older ones that might be suitable for timber, not necessarily cutting down all the little ones for firewood, but, you know,
gotcha.
there's things happening.
Well, thank you for that one. Let's jump back on the phones here. It's the Science Forum, and Sharanya, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Good afternoon, everybody.
Hi.
I promise this is not stinky bugs, but I have two questions. The first question is about a lot of news that I read about the superbugs. The question is there anything we can do collectively as human beings in our lifestyle and lifestyle choices that can, you know, not make these superbugs more stronger? That's number one.
Okay.
The second question is, on the other side, I'm also reading news about like flesh-eating bacteria, brain-eating algae. So I'm wondering if those, you know, species existed before, or are they also up and coming, or are we hearing it as a part of the awareness and social media, et cetera?
I have thought that exact same question, Sharanya. So let's get our scientists on this.
You're not going to like the answer.
I know your answer, but I
go ahead, Roger.
Send your kids out to play in the dirt.
There is that. That at least will keep them healthier. There is normal flora. So superbugs, we're talking mostly bacteria here. First thing, Roger's right. Send your kid. Don't overclean your homes. That actually leads to more allergies in children.
Mission accomplished.
There you go. Playing in the dirt is a good thing. There are soil bacteria that are natural competitors to many of these bugs, including something like C. diff, which is a terrible bacterium that some people can get infected with.
Mm-hmm.
A couple other ones, when you go to the doctor and you do get a prescription for antibiotics, you finish the bottle. I know you're going to feel better in 3 or 4 days, and you're like, why do I want to do this? You need to finish the bottle. What you're doing is you're playing roulette with your gut system when you only take some of those pills. It's the whole course is there to remove all of the pathogenic, the bad bacteria.
Don't they overprescribe them?
Well, yes, but you still need to take them all.
No, I disagree about that. And thank you for
let me explain how it works. You've got a shotgun and you're shooting every day at a bunch of bacteria.
Don't point that at me.
If there are some that you don't kill and you're getting 360 degrees around you, then those bacteria will then prove that they have survived the onslaught and they will go on to make more. If it's a factor of intensity, like you take your pill and then you wait, it's supposed to be 12 hours, but you take it like 17 hours later, they divide every 20 minutes and have babies every 20 minutes.
Okay.
So they've had enough chance to evolve against the pressures of bacteria.
All right, but what about the second question, which I find fascinating, the brain-eating amoeba and the flesh-eating bacteria? We hear about this now. I don't recall ever hearing about it 20, 30 years ago. Are these new things, or is it just that we're hearing about it for the first time?
Well, the brain-eating amoeba has been around for a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, we scientists talk about it, you know, behind closed doors.
Great.
The flesh-eating bacteria is really a product of our use of antibiotics since World War II.
All right.
So because of using the penicillins, the amoxicillins, and the clavamox, and so on and so forth, we've created an evolutionary path that was unintended. So now we have bacteria that can...
Yeah.
Yep. Well, thanks for that call. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's the Science Forum today. Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, Roger Giboni, and Carmen Greenwood here. And Karen in Schenectady. Karen, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. A few weeks ago, I collected a bunch of very wiggly earthworms from an area that a neighbor had uncovered and put them in a coffee cup, a takeaway coffee cup with a plastic lid that the little sippy part had been broken off of, with some leaves to keep them cool and give them something to hide in. And I probably picked up at least 20 to 25 of various sizes. And we put them in the refrigerator, as we usually do, and use them as we want. Well, I wasn't around. They were from my dad, who likes to fish. And he recently told me that he went to the refrigerator to get a worm, and I don't know when he had last been in there, but he said there was not one worm in there, that they had disappeared.
Uh-oh.
And that there was no sign of them in the refrigerator.
Spontaneous degeneration.
What you could have done.
Well, this is an interesting one. All right. What do we think?
Are they hiding out in the motor? I can't imagine they could climb up the sides. I don't know how they would get out of a refrigerator.
I think that there's a very good possibility that they did climb up the sides of the sippy cup.
Amazing. Amazing.
They're very strong. Very good escape artists. Yes. I know those worms you're talking about. They are very good escape artists.
There's a drain in the bottom of your there's a drain hole in the bottom of your refrigerator. If there's any condensation, it'll go to the bottom. And there's a pan under the refrigerator, which is kind of like the start of primordial ooze if you don't clean it out for a while.
That's the worm pan.
Everybody got to
wonderful.
It but me.
All right, Karen.
We have to keep a big. Great. Thank you. That's probably where they are then.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
And they're growing.
Yes. They'll take over soon.
This is awesome, they say.
Rich in Albany. Rich, you're on.
Yeah, good afternoon, everyone. A quick plug to college before the question. It teaches you a communication style and collaboration that it's impossible to get in high school. So it's worthwhile. My question is, let me phrase it this way. A few years ago, all of the personal care products and household cleaning products in my house were replaced with what was promoted as natural, free of X, Y, and Z. And I was just curious as to what the panel's thoughts were on the difference between a risk-based approach versus a hazard-based approach when it comes to consumer products. You know, risk-based, it says this particular methyl ethyl death is safe at X parts per million. The hazard-based approach basically says methyl ethyl death is not safe on any level. So just curious as to what your thoughts were as that continues to play out, as the millennials continue to become the major purchasers in the marketplace.
All right.
I think that's a really great question that takes more time than we have, but I'll see if I can parse it out.
30 seconds.
I know. Sometimes when we're risk averse, we create antidotes that are more dangerous than the risk itself. I'm thinking of antibacterial additives to soaps. In the microbiology course of which I'm a part, we do a hand washing and then hand washing with antibacterial soap. And it's the act of hand washing that cleans your hands. It's not the antibacterial. And the antibacterial triclosan has been banned in Europe because there are adverse effects that have been documented with it. So I think in reality, there are certain things that I will, you know, I'm not opposed to having my food irradiated to kill the bacteria that can give me Giardia, or they not bacteria, but can parasites and bacteria that could make me sick from a foodborne illness. But other people would be more scared of the radiation involved in nuking my chicken before I buy it at the store. A lot of that is just the words people use and understanding that not all radiation is bad. Radiation from the sun, for example, is light. I mean, it's visible light for the most part. UV radiation is not necessarily great, but you have to have some consumer sensitivity to it in order to know where your risks really are. But Roger's groaning over there.
Yeah, well, a lot of the risks are lawyer-derived as well. So you have to be somewhat careful about that because a good example is bacon. You put nitrites in bacon because that preserves it longer so that people who keep it in their fridge too long don't wind up dying or something. Okay. But at the same time, it can produce nitrosamines, which are carcinogenic.
Okay.
So you have to sort of balance the ability of people to deal with their own selves against their ability to deal with that.
Well, yes, there was a time when one of the fast food chains was taking a coffee cup and putting it at the drive-thru and putting it in a bag to hand you a bag because there was less chance the coffee would spill on you.
Right.
Rather than just hand you the coffee cup and say, hey, this is hot. So now the compromise is they don't put it in the bag because it was still spilling anyway. And it says, caution, very hot liquid inside. And it's like, okay, I got it. I can drive a car. I know my coffee's hot.
As long as the lawyers are satisfied. Let's go to John in Del Mar. John, you're on.
Hi. If your body's 98 degrees, why do you feel hot and uncomfortable when it's only, 85 or 90.
That's all to do with humidity. It's 95 and not humid is fine, but what happens is your body cools off by losing heat through its skin. If there's a lot of water in there, the water winds up taking that energy and effectively it suffocates it to some extent. I think I'm a bit off there, Barb.
Well, just that sweating, the evaporative cooling of sweating is there. And so if you're wet but the environment's cool, then your sweat will evaporate quicker given the same temperature, and it will take with it the energy to give you that cool sensation.
Okay.
Even a wet 40-degree day can feel really close, and then you feel clammy because it's the same thing. Now your sweat is cold, and you're cold too.
Right. Thanks for the call, John. Does it feel warm in here?
Yes.
Yeah, it's too warm. And, you know, I checked the thermostat outside. It looks like it should be fine, and it's not. So I'm with you, John. It's very uncomfortable, and let's complain some more. Janice in Voorheesville, you have about a minute.
Hi, this is Janice. Yes.
Hi.
I have a question about rotation.
Okay.
I noticed that in a hurricane, there's a dead space in the very center.
Right.
But the turntable, when a record turns, is there a dead space in the center somewhere? Or when the earth rotates, is there a dead space in the center?
Huh. Who wants?
Well, we're talking about angular velocity, right? So the angular velocity is the same regardless of the radius. But the linear velocity changes based on the radius. So what you're calling a dead spot is actually moving very, very slowly.
Even if it's one point in the dead center.
But, you know, the center is an infinitesimal point in the middle.
Right.
So the linear velocity, the feet per second, is much, much lower as you get closer to the center versus going on the outside. Remember when you were a kid, you swung the string around and you would hear the snapping at the end of it,
yeah.
Right? It's because it's breaking the sound barrier at the end.
You're kidding me.
No, that's why it's
I can break the sound barrier by
Absolutely.
Doing that?
Absolutely.
I'm going to do that today.
But the radial velocity is constant so that's radians per second or degrees per second, and that's constant regardless of the radius. Right. So there is no dead spot, to answer your question.
And just to end with the fact that a record is a solid object, and therefore the velocity will decrease as you go towards the center, while a hurricane is air moving around, and therefore it can actually go down to zero at the center.
It's as if you were to throw sand on top of a fast-moving record, the sand would move to the outside of the record.
All right. Well, that's all we have time for on the Science Forum today. Support comes from the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world, waldorfsaratoga.org. Mother Earth Storehouse, serving the Hudson Valley since 1978, offering a variety of seasonal items, including gluten-free, vegan, and allergen-free desserts, MotherEarthStorehouse.com. At the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art, Amherst, Massachusetts, presenting three exhibitions, Eric Carle Makes a Book, Sylvester and the Magic Pebble, and the Picture Book Odysseys of Peter Cease, now on view, carlemuseum.org. Well, thanks again to Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, Carmen Greenwood, and Roger Giboni for being here today. Thank you for listening. Terrific calls on the Science Forum. We will do it again. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Amber Sickles took the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, the fine folks from the Grillsdale event taking place in Hillsdale, New York, will fire things up on a Food Friday. Right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.